CAP's success in advocating for Arizona families reaches beyond our borders. God increases his blessings, preparing and using willing people to do good. In this episode, Kathy speaks with a former CAP team member, now Center for Christian Virtues president, and his wife, both deeply involved in doing public policy in a biblical way and living out lives from a Christian worldview. Here now is Kathy Herod with Aaron and Maria Baer.
On this edition of Engage Arizona, we're going to tackle some of the cultural issues of the day with two of the most engaged, brilliant, deep-thinking people I know. Also two of my very favorite people in the whole wide world. Both write, speak, and lead out of their commitment to biblical truths. It's a special podcast with dear friends, Aaron and Maria Baer. You all know them as being Arizonans for seven years, something like that, now making a difference in Ohio, their home state, and also on the national stage. A bit of a background, Aaron and Maria met as journalism students at Ohio University. I think some call it the university there, not so sure. They moved to Arizona early in their marriage. They are now in Ohio with their two precious young daughters. Maria writes for Gospel Coalition, Christianity Today, World Magazine. She's a senior writer and co-host of Breakpoint This Week, the podcast with the Colson Center for Christian Worldview. Aaron is president of the Center for Christian Virtue, the Family Policy Council for Ohio. Aaron does in Ohio what we do in Arizona with CAP. You probably remember that for 5 years, Aaron was CAP's communications director. Then he was the policy advisor to Arizona Attorney General Mark Brnovich. Aaron has appeared on national news shows with his writings being published in USA Today, Ohio, and Arizona newspapers. Now, I think it's still that one is a Packers fan and the other is a Steelers fan, at least when they're playing against those two teams. But I think both of them are Cubs fans, and so that keeps the marriage together. But they are both serving in ministries that are on the cutting edge of what it means to be a Bible-believing Jesus follower in today's culture. So welcome, Aaron Maria. So glad to have you with us today.
Kathy, it's real special to be with you, and we love you, and we miss Arizona, and we're just can never say enough about what you've done and what Cap did for our family, and so yeah, just so grateful for you.
We still consider you the Arizona grandmother to our little ones. That's what we always tell them.
See now, and they're bringing that up, my major complaint, because yes, I was supposed to be the Arizona grandmother, but they took the girls to Ohio, so I'm still the Arizona grandmother, just we're miles and miles apart. But anyway, well, let me start off with, Maria, what is Breakpoint in the Colson Center?
Sure, so the Colson Center for Christian Worldview grew out of the ministry of Chuck Colson, who has now passed, but he had a really remarkable conversion after serving in the Nixon administration and serving time in prison, actually, after the Watergate scandal. But was an incredibly eloquent speaker and loved Jesus and had a really incredible mind for the Bible and the scriptures and theology. And he had a special heart for prison ministry, but he also really had a heart for helping equip Christians to know their Bibles, not just to know Jesus kind of on a surface level. So he started something called Prison Fellowship. And several years ago, out of Prison Fellowship came a second ministry called the Colson Center for Christian Worldview. So many years ago when Chuck was still with us, he used to share daily commentaries on radio stations across the country. And it just, you know, got bigger and bigger, and they were airing on more and more stations throughout his life. But these were, he was really taking biblical truth and applying it just kind of to the issues of the day. You know, recently I went back and listened to some of his commentaries that he wrote and shared immediately following 9/11. Like I'm talking like the day after. And it was incredible. I mean, he just was so brilliant, but also just had clearly such a close relationship with Jesus that it felt like hearing, you know, some ancient wisdom from a person in the same time as us, which is a really special thing. So we're kind of trying to carry on that tradition now. So Breakpoint at the Colson Center shares a daily commentary on our podcast, which you can find at Breakpoint on any podcast channel, but it also still airs on several radio stations around the country. And then once a week, we also have a podcast called Breakpoint This Week. That's a little bit longer. This is the show that I co-host with our now the president of the Colson Center for Christian Worldview, John Stone Street. We kind of talk through the week from a Christian worldview, kind of trying to carry on that legacy of Chuck's, where we try to apply a biblical worldview to everything we see going on around us. And in recent months, Colson Center also launched several other podcasts. There's lots of other great resources and articles at breakpoint.org. They have something called the Colson Fellows Program, where we educate people just in how to live and speak to each other from a Christian worldview. So it's a really cool organization. I'm super excited to be part of it.
So define for us Christian worldview or biblical worldview. What do you mean when you use that term?
Oh, I love that question. So I actually, what I mean when I say that, I think, is seeing the world as it really is. So the Bible, as we know as Christians, is an accurate picture of history and ontology, meaning it's the accurate picture of how we were made and why. It's what God has chosen to reveal to us about our nature and the nature of the world he made, as well as the nature of our calling. And how we're supposed to live with one another, and what it means to be followers of Jesus as we look toward, you know, spending eternity with him. So a Christian worldview, the way I look at it, it means understanding everything in the world, you know, my daily life from the smallest task to the biggest piece of news, through that lens, just realizing that everything I hear and see and learn tells me something about God, tells me something about the way he made the world, and has to be understood within the framework that he gave us in the scriptures. So I think that's what we mean. There's no topic that's outside of God's truth, you know?
Okay, so Aaron, let's bring you in. So Aaron, what is the Center for Christian Virtue?
Well, Kathy, you captured it really well. CCV is kind of Ohio's CAP. So we say we are Ohio's largest Christian public policy organization. We advocate for public policy that reflects the truth of the gospel. I think that's one of the things that, you know, what was really influential for me on this, and I don't want to speak for Maria, but even hearing Maria talk about Christian worldview reminds me of when I was in Arizona with you and Wayne Grudem wrote the book Politics According to the Bible, which, of course, is dedicated to CAP and to you. And he you know, took 66 issues, political issues, and wrote, you know, what is a biblical perspective on these things. The fact that he was, you know, he took everything from life and those sort of core issues that we often think about, but even things like farm subsidies, and said, hey, we're going to shine the God's word on these and see what it has to say. And some things are real definitive, like, you know, don't kill unborn children, and marriage is the union of one man and one woman. But even in you know, non-social conservative or things like that, there's biblical wisdom there. And so for us, we want to encourage lawmakers and policymakers to be thinking biblically about public policy, about righteousness, about justice. And then we really emphasize issues like life and marriage and family and religious freedom, sort of those cornerstones of what allows people to thrive, allows children to succeed. Educational choice has become more and more of a big issue for us. And that's what we, you know, we just like CAP, we advocate at the Ohio State House, you guys go to the Arizona legislature, and just work with lawmakers to pass good bills and stop bad ones.
So how would you define, you use the term Christian virtue. So just like I asked Maria about biblical worldview, define Christian virtue. What do you mean by that term?
Yeah, you know, when we did the name change from, we were Citizens for Community Values, and we changed to Center for Christian Virtue, partly to keep CCV. We like that acronym, good to remember. But, you know, for us with Christian virtue in particular, we always say it's concerned with not just what you stand for, but how you stand for it. Making sure that, you know, we want to stand for righteousness, but we also want to do so prudentially and gracefully and with love and winsomely. Respecting our and valuing even our opponents and our enemies. Again, all things that I got to learn and see firsthand training up under you, Kathy. But that was really for us, especially in this, you know, our policy director today is a guy that worked in public schools for 20 years, African-American guy, has kind of worked culturally for a number of years, both nationally and internationally. And he talks so much about the thing he's most concerned about is division today, both in the church and then outside the church. And Christian virtue is concerned as much of, you know, as much about doing the right thing and also doing it the right way. keeping in mind the most important thing is knowing Jesus.
Well stated. Now, the two of you began dating as college students. Would you have ever thought that you would be in this place today? And it reminds me of when Colson Center often says, God has made you for this time and place. And that is evident, I think, in both of your lives. But just share just a little bit about how has this happened in your lives, that you go from college students to now being married with two daughters, both involved in significant worldview-based ministries?
It's really funny. I think the short answer is, this was God's plan, but no, I don't think we would have ever, I don't think we could have ever painted this picture on our own. I think looking back shortly after Aaron and I started dating in school, I got an internship at Focus on the Family. And that was way more pivotal than I think we expected at the time. So my internship was largely involved with writing for Brio, which is the best magazine of all time. I was a journalism major and a magazine specialty. So I was really excited about that internship. But I learned so much there. I mean, I got to go through the Truth Project with Del Tackett and just do all sorts of worldview classes alongside this internship. And looking back now, it's fun to consider God's hand on that because, again, Aaron and I had just started dating. So every night I'm calling, you know, I'm in Colorado. Aaron's back here in Ohio. I'm calling him every night, telling him everything I learned. We're discovering areas where we agree or disagree or things we hadn't really thought about before and all this sort of this stuff. And it just was a really strong grounding, I think, for both of us in biblical worldview. And actually, at that same time, I read the book Why You Can't Stay Silent by Tom Minery, who was a vice president at Focus on the Family at the time. And so this is a book about, you know, Christians' responsibility to engage in public policy in the United States, especially where we're a republic and we are asking for the people's participation. And I was so changed by this book. I bought it for Aaron, I bought it for my dad, I think I bought it for everyone in my family. And I wormed my way up to Mr. Minery's office and got him to sign it for everybody. But our relationship with him grew through CAP and through Focus. And now Mr. Minery is actually from Ohio and lives here now and is on the board of CCV. And we are, you know, we get to see he and Deb regularly and they're a big part of our lives. So, but that's just, I think that story just illustrates that God has orchestrated this every step of the way from college until now and through our marriage and through Aaron getting his job with you. That was incredibly pivotal for both of us. I mean, I don't know what our life would look like if he hadn't, but yeah. I think that's a major step on the journey too.
Of course, I remember Aaron was, a year out of college, I think, when he started CAP.
Not even.
And he likes to joke about how many interviews I put him through.
Six interviews.
I actually came across the notes, and like the final interview, I had a question like something, are you going to, you know, that what I valued the most was something like being flexible and teachable. I can't remember what else. And then how, and if I redlined a lot of your stuff, the first, you know, part, was that going to be okay? And you survived. We both survived. But
I did. My writings early on bled. They just, but they made me better. Let's, yeah.
Well, but I had the delightful seat and the blessing of seeing you really catch the passion for this work and the calling. But just share any thoughts you have on that.
Yeah, no, I think that's right, Kathy. I think when Maria and I talk about this a lot, especially with how hectic life is now with two little ones and, you know, just the world we live in and the work that Maria and I do. But when we get to sort of step back and if we just put our life on paper, what it is today, we would not believe that God would allow us to be doing things that we're both passionate about and feel called to. And I think there's a number of things that's really big in there. One, you know, people like you, Kathy, especially who are willing to take risks, you know, and I say it's a risk because, you know, I was a 22-year-old that didn't have any real connection to the organization, and you and the leadership team at the time were willing to give me an opportunity and take advantage of that. But especially when I think about what Maria has done through now, and this is one of the things that, especially when I'm talking to you know, high school students or college students, I really can't say enough about what Maria has done, where, yeah, she's writing for CT and World and and Colson Center now, and has these amazing opportunities in doing, you know, the radio program. But what nobody saw is, you know, for 7 years, Maria was writing radio copy every night at 10 o'clock for 2 hours, getting paid $25 a city, and fine tuning her craft and working hard. And, you know, I think there's a lot of people who look at stuff like what Maria does today and think, oh, I'd love to do that. And that'd be, you know, I understand why a lot of folks would love to do that, but do they love the idea of putting the work in, to get there? And I think that's one of the things that, you know, is really important about, having these opportunities at this point in life is what Maria's, you know, all the work and effort she put in to fine tune her craft. And, you know, like you said, I'm just hard headed enough that I can get told no a million times and not quit. But, you know, having the opportunity to keep trying and get better under you and have people like you give an opportunity to train up, I think was a really big part of those early years for us.
Well, and I learned as much from Aaron and Maria as well. But, you know, I've often said that Aaron kept me from being what we call old school, and that we want to be innovative at CAP. We want to be, you know, on God's mission, certainly. And Aaron, and still to this day, because we're watching everything that you're doing in Ohio. But let me shift. I mean, so you've got, you know, two young daughters. You see everything that's going on. So what concerns you most in the culture today as you are parents trying to raise your daughters?
I mean, I think my most immediate, but probably both of our most immediate concerns is making sure they know the Lord. And I feel really blessed that we have found an incredible Christian school system here. And that we're still in a situation where we're free to do that. It feels safe to do that. That feels critical. I think transgender ideology is especially concerning to me as a mom, not just because of the issue itself, which is obviously dangerous. And I think I've never seen in my life, and you probably haven't either, Kathy, a situation where the medical community has so readily adopted experimental practices and even language that is, you know, so anti-science. You know, there's no doctors who don't believe that kids should transition immediately or take cross-sex hormones immediately, even as young as 9, 10, 11, those doctors are being silenced. That's really scary. But I think in a broader sense, what's really scary about that for me is that it gets to the nature of reality. And this is like what we were talking about with a biblical worldview. If I can't go into a doctor's office or take our girls to a doctor and know that that doctor has a real definition of woman and man and is going to treat us according to what gender we are, you know, it feels like the ground shifting under our feet. I don't know what to do about that. I mean, I'm not a doctor. My parents aren't doctors. You know, it's a scary place to be when it feels like our grip on reality culturally is loosening. And you know, it's hard to know what challenges the girls will face as they get older that come out of that. I have confidence that the transgender kind of craze will slow down and turn around once a lot of the kids who are going through this experimental treatment grow up and are able to testify to how harmful it was. I have confidence that this will turn around, but what else could it open in terms of a, you know, a Pandora's box of letting go of, you know, truth claims? That leads to some other really scary cultural things.
So, Aaron, on the policy front, and speak to that too, because I think what Maria said a while ago is critical, that we don't have the testimonies, in a sense, lined up of the young people who are in, and we're hearing more and more about it, but they're who in their 20s, and they're basically scarred for life because of decisions they made of teenagers and that their parents helped facilitate. But in Ohio, you've tried to address it from a policy standpoint in the Ohio legislature. So speak to the challenges to try to even bring that into the policy arena.
Yeah, no, you know, I think, Kathy, this reminds me, I remember when I was in Arizona and we tried to do some bills around the issue of IVF or artificial reproductive technology. And when you really looked into that area, you saw that public policy had not caught up to the science and the experimentation that was going on with women, you know, stuff that Jennifer Lahl has done such a great job of sort of exposing over the years. I think you're seeing that same thing with the transgender issue. I think you're seeing the same thing in the education space as well, where you have a policy environment that's just not being honest or maybe doesn't have the courage to step up and deal with it. So, you know, things that 10 years, even 10 years ago when I was in Arizona, if somebody would have come to us and said, hey, we need to run a bill to say boys can't play in girls sports, or we need to run a bill that says you can't put children on puberty blocking drugs for the purpose of gender transition, we would have said, why, who in the world, what are you talking about? Who would do that? Why would we need to do that? But today, these seemingly obvious truths are now controversial, and it's too scary to touch them. And so those are the questions for me, Kathy, today when we're thinking about these issues are both, what are the things we have to get straightened out today and quickly? But also, what are the like Maria said, what's the long term, when we don't have even a reality basis that we can connect with our opponents on, what are the things that are going to come down the pike? And I don't think nobody would have imagined we'd be where we are today, compared to just, you know, 5-10 years ago.
Well, and look at this discussion, even look at how quickly when we pivot to talking about issues, transgender ideology is what comes up first. And I think, yeah. That is what everyone is seeing moving forward at rapid speed. We will connect. There's an article that Maria's written for Gospel Coalition a few months ago, 3 ways parents can help kids navigate transgender ideology. And I think that's what's on every parent's mind. We will be sure to include a link to that. But one thing that you say in here, Maria, and I think it's important to remember this, is that kids with gender dysphoria are hurting. I mean, that this is, that this whole issue, it comes from a world of hurt, and often there's something underneath it. But just kind of briefly, what you've seen in this article as far as how do you help children, especially older children, as they start to go through this?
Yeah, this has been a learning experience for me because, even after reading Abigail Schreier's book, Irreversible Damage, just about the incredible spike in claims of transgenderism among particularly young girls, it feels clearly like a sort of social contagion, right? Similar to something like eating disorders or self-harm that we've seen come in waves in the past. And I think that that's right. I think it is behaving that way among young girls in particular. But the thing to remember is, I was reading some research on this recently, it is still an accurate sentiment. Like, the kids aren't lying that they feel that way. They're not just saying it to fit in. Even though it may have been brought on by this sort of social contagion, it's still a very real thing that they're experiencing. And so that's what I think makes it all the more tragic that the medical community has gone so quickly into saying, well, you must transition and you must now take hormones, instead of, what kids in that situation need is a bigger breadth of treatment. What else could this, what other issues could be under the surface here that are coming to the fore? And so I think for parents of kids who are actually struggling with dysphoria, I guess I would encourage them to really push your doctors, and in particular your counselors or psychologists, to explore other areas. In the same way that an eating disorder could be manifesting stress or anxiety or trauma in another area of life, I'm sure that this is doing something similar. Even if the stress is just, that struggle to fit in or struggle at school, which can be really hard for kids, but there have got to be doctors out there still who will be willing to explore those areas. And that's certainly what I'd encourage parents to do.
Erin, what's the church's role in all of this? I mean, you've got a major church outreach. In really all the issues, but what's the church's role in this and in reaching young people? Yeah, I've had pastors say it's the issue that they get asked about the most.
Yeah, no, honestly, Kathy, to me, this is one of these things that this is one of the most important areas for the church to speak up on, because, we say this all the time around here, that the church is the only one today that has the ability to speak into this boldly, because we have the Holy Spirit. Everybody who speaks out on this, and Kathy, you know this better than most people out there, everybody who speaks out on this is going to get canceled. It's going to happen. The reality is when you have the Holy Spirit, you're okay with that. You know what I mean? You have hope secured. You have an eternal salvation there that they can't be taken away from you. And so the church is the only one today that has that ability to speak out on this boldly and lovingly. and really provide clarity. You know, we say this to pastors all the time, that if you're not speaking about this issue, somebody else is discipling your people on this. And really, you're probably the only one that's not speaking on the issue in that person's life. They're getting this sexual revolution, gender ideology pressure on them every day from all angles. And really for a pastor, it cuts to the heart of, you know, it's too often we see folks just kind of want to brush this aside as just a political issue that they want to stay out of. But, you know, as Maria and Colson Center does such a good job, it cuts to the heart of what does it mean to be made in the image of God? And so are we nothing more than just, you know, body parts and a mindset and, you know, that we're just, we can make ourselves into whatever we want, or were we made with a purpose that's beautiful and holy? And so for pastors to you, and when you think about that, those questions in particular, they have so much bigger implications for everything, including salvation. For the church right now, this is one of those things of really trying to encourage the church to show boldness and recognize when the church is afraid to speak up on these things, they're actually communicating to their people that they should be afraid. And that's one of the worst things to do today.
Well stated. Let's switch issues a little bit and just talk about the life issue, because when we share our concerns about the division that's going on in our country, as we see the U.S. Supreme Court having December 1st hearings on Mississippi's limit on abortions after 15 weeks, the abortion industry has its gravy train ending with the real possibility that Roe versus Wade and Casey could be overturned, if not in Dobbs, then there are a number of other cases that could be used by the court to do that. Let states regulate pre-viability abortions and on and on. So just comments on just the hysteria from the abortion industry and what, you know, if Roe's overturned, when Roe is overturned, I should say, what can we expect to see, when this happens?
Yeah, you know, I think, Kathy, one of the things that you just touched on that I don't think we've spent a ton of time wrapping our minds around, but we're starting to get a little bit of a taste of this, is the abortion industry. This is, you know, we've always known it's big business. It's $500 million a year in federal subsidies on top of everything else, all the other ways that Planned Parenthood and these abortion groups get taxpayer dollars. This is a massive industry. And they're not just going to let this money disappear without an incredible fight. The road to ending abortion, I think the biggest thing for the church to have in mind, for the pro-life community to have in mind, the road to ending abortion doesn't end with overturning Roe. There's going to be a lot more. We can't imagine. The amount of money and the amount of time that these folks who have been executing these dangerous and deadly practices have spent into thinking about going into a post-Roe world, they put a lot of time in there, and we don't know what they're going to come up with. And I think this is one of those things that we need to start wrapping our mind around. Yeah, let's have laws in place in our states to end as many abortions as we can as possible. Let's be ready for all that. Let's even get, you know, let's get our pregnancy center game stepped up and our adoption and foster care game stepped up. That's all good. But we should just be ready for some things from the left and from the abortion community that we can't anticipate and be ready to fight that, because it's going to be a long road to protect as many unborn lives as possible.
And of course, at CAP, and I know you do this in Ohio too, we care as much about the woman going into the abortion clinic as we do her unborn child. And we've seen increasing calls, at least in Arizona and really throughout the country, from some on the pro-life side to call women baby killers, to really go after women that they're killing their children, and yelling things that are really unfortunate. And this is, again, where, Maria, you wrote another, I think, Gospel Coalition piece about that most abortion-minded women aren't calculating killers. They're afraid. And just, you know, share about, you know, what, yes, women who are having an abortion, what's driving them? What's leading them to that?
Yeah, so when we first moved to Ohio, I started volunteering with a pregnancy center that's just down the street here. Part of that was you had inspired me to do that. But I also had just had our first baby and was wanting to help and that sort of thing. And I'm not sure what I was expecting when I went in there, but what I the women I met with really shattered my expectations. I think the pro-choice industry paints a picture of, you know, the woman who's getting an abortion as, you know, this just very self-empowered and, you know, usually academic, and they have big career goals and they're taking charge of their own life and they're going to be empowered and make this decision. And I think the vast, vast majority of women do not fit that bill. And the irony of that is, I think that's hurt their cause for a few reasons, but the pro-life community, I think, sometimes has taken that at face value and assumed, for good reason, there are women, you know, in Hollywood and in other powerful places who are outspoken on social media or elsewhere who talk about abortion. They talk about it in that way. Like, it's something to be super proud of. You know, I remember Lena Dunham saying she wished she had gotten one, you know, just that kind of absurd stuff. But again, the vast majority of women actually in these situations are, terrified, right? I mean, I pregnancy is difficult. You know that as a mom. Our children, we were hoping for and praying for, and we have a stable family and lots of support, and I was scared. So I can imagine what it's like if you've got financial issues, if you have an abusive spouse, or
you're a single mom. You're going to be a single mom.
You're going to be a single mom, or you have. And I was really floored by the number of women who came into our pregnancy center. And their first reaction upon finding out they were pregnant was telling me who was going to be angry at them. My dad's going to be so mad. My boss is going to be so mad. I just got this new job. My boss is going to kill me. You know, it was never like, oh, I know what I'll do. I have total agency here. I feel empowered and whatever. And I think that's super important to know, A, so that we can be compassionate for these women. I think if we're just looking at them as like really morally objectionable and we're like disgusted by their decision, we're not going to get anywhere in terms of reaching them. But also, that's not how Jesus would look at them either. I think he would challenge them with the truth, which the pregnancy center world is doing, and so are you, and so is CCV. But from a spirit of, we know how hard this is and how can we help you? And here's parenting classes and diapers and adoption referrals and all the stuff that goes along with that support. I've really seen the pregnancy center world do an amazing job of that.
I'll just say one other thing about it, Kathy, to me, which is a lot of times the you know, baby killer message, I would argue, is just very selfish. And it's not about actually ending abortion. It's about making you feel good that you got to call somebody a baby killer. Because if your heart is actually ending abortion, you'd be thinking about what's the most effective way to go about this. And we have, you know, years and years of data that shows that that's not the most effective way of communicating on abortion. Yes, I think everybody who is pro-life would readily acknowledge that abortion is ending the life of an unborn child. And if our concern is stopping as much of that as possible, we need to think about effective communication in that. And so often the hardcore, you know, baby killer message seems to be more about the communicator than the person we're trying to communicate to.
Well stated. And I think it's so often that women don't know what else to do, that when that it's almost like it's either the baby or me, and they don't see how they can survive. And that's where the incredible work of pregnancy resource centers and the need to have those frontline people on the front line, like Maria volunteering at the local center, that's what our churches, all of us as individuals, what can we do to support women? And then when they have their babies and decide to parent, it doesn't end there. That we often, I think, lose sight of that also, how can the church, the body of Christ, come around and support women and all of that. Well, as we start to come to the end of our time together, I want to get back to you guys as parents, and you guys certainly are training up your girls in the way that they should go. What are just, you know, how do you do that? What does it look like for you guys as far as, you know, day in and day out, what you're doing with your girls to raise them in the admonition of the Lord? Just some practical steps for those parents that are out there.
Oh gosh, that's a great question. I feel like I should be asking you this question. You know, like I mentioned, we've found a really wonderful school that is, you know, teaches the Bible and teaches Naomi, our oldest, about Jesus. You know, I think I think what we really try to do at home, and I'm speaking for Aaron and I now, so correct me if I'm wrong, but is just talk about God as if it's, you know, not compartmentalize it. It's not like, you know, we don't sit down at dinner and talk about God and then that's the only time we do. And, you know, this is our God time, or, you know, we're going to read the Bible and do Naomi's little homework assignment where she memorizes her verse and then that's going to be it. I think I really try, and my mom did such a good job of this, to make it feel as real to her as it does to me. So if I this might seem a little bit weird. I was doing this earlier today and I wondered, is this weird? But I did it anyway. If I am praying or if I'm reading the scripture and the girls are around, I do it out loud because I want them to, even though they're not doing it directly with me in that moment, I want them to hear me doing it because I want it to feel as real to them as it does to me. It's not just something I'm teaching you, you know, just like you're learning how to read or you're learning math. It's not just another subject or another part of life. This is our whole life. This is why we're here. This is why we love each other as a family. So I try to do a lot of my devotional stuff really visibly in front of them. And we also, I think we're pretty open with them. You know, we tell them about what Aaron's working on, you know, within reason, obviously. We're not going to talk about violent things, but we tell them what he's working on and why it's important. I've taken her to the pregnancy center before, I've taken both of them now. I want both of them to be exposed to the fact that other people need things more than we do. And what I mean by that is they're not as financially stable or, you know, they don't have the community that we have. I just want them to be exposed to people that we can help and be creative about helping them. The last thing I'll say is Lifeway has a lot of really great kids books, like really thoughtful, theologically sound children's books that have really been incredible. And so I can't recommend that highly enough. That has sparked, a lot of those books have sparked a lot of great conversation in our house.
I think one of the things Maria and I talk a lot about is, you know, trying to maintain a place with the girls that, a trust with our girls that when they get exposed to something and we're not there to put it in context, they feel comfortable enough to come talk to us. I think one of the things that Maria has done really well with our daughters is kept a great open conversation with them, even at their young age, even as toddlers, so that, and something that we want to try to maintain through the years. You know, I think the other thing that I'll just say, and this is something bigger picture, I read Tim Keller's prayer book a few years ago, and it's really impacted my prayer life and getting into daily prayer. But daily praying for their souls. I just can't say that enough, of just daily praying for the Spirit to move on their hearts, and to draw them near, and then to trust him with them. And that's so hard, that we don't have control over them. But it's something that I think is the biggest picture for us is how do we pray for them? Children are a blessing. And Kathy, you know, when I first started with Cap, you know, and Maria and I got married young, we didn't think we wanted kids. And I think Cap, you and Cap really helped soften our hearts on that. And that's one thing that when we talk to younger folks today is, hey, we have a very bad view of kids, today in our world. And we both felt convicted and repented of that. And the best thing that we've had in our lives is our girls, and we bring them everywhere with us, like the Packers game. but really, just trying to be there and be open with them is so, so important.
What a blessing to hear the two of you just talk about where you are, about your hearts, about your focus on the Lord, on your family, and on the difference that you're making in Ohio. And as I said at the beginning of this, really the national impact that you both are having. Maria's writing, Aaron has quickly become one of the real leaders among the Family Policy Council movement, doing innovative things. And Aaron, how big is your staff now? You've taken it from how many to how many?
So we started with two full-time, two part-time. We're 13 full-time and 3 part-time today.
So he's got the Ohio Christian Education Network, where I've stolen the name. We've got the Arizona Christian Education Network. And we go back and forth all the time. And we could talk, we'll have to do this again, because we could talk about so many more issues that we didn't get to today. But may God continue to bless the work, your parenting, just all that you're doing, that we're just grateful for both of you. And may the Lord bless you and keep you.